he knew that I'd been in Vietnam, and he said, do you want to go? I said, well, I would love to. He said, well, I'm going to send you, not to do a story, just to go. So I went. It was cathartic. For me and all of us who went.
Today's episode is sponsored by EncourageX, where you can manage all of your encouragement needs in one place. Personal, authentic, and consistent. EncourageX.com, where relationships mean everything.
In part one of my conversation with Bill Baeza, my former co-anchor and I took a deep dive into the media and its role in civil discourse. This week, the conversation takes a more personal turn as Bill reflects on his service in Vietnam and some unfinished business.
So I want to talk a little bit about your time in Vietnam, if that's okay.
Sure.
Because you have recently been doing some stories and sharing some of your experiences as a Marine in Vietnam. You did a beautiful, beautiful piece on Veterans Day this year.
Thank you.
It brought me to tears. I mean, at the end of it, I was crying. I really was. Mm-hmm. And last week, you posted on social media a little bit about it. And I said, you know, I sat next to you all those years at the anchor desk, and we never, ever, obviously, talked about Vietnam. And you've started to talk about it. And I wonder, what did it feel like when you came back to the country, because it was such an unpopular war, mm-hmm. and so many veterans felt that they were just forgotten and not appreciated, and they felt like the other. That's mm-hmm. an example of you know, one type of feeling like you're the other. What was that like for you?
Well, there was no pride on reentry. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I came right out of the Marine Corps, right to college. So I made a point of not letting anyone know that I was in the Marine Corps, or that I was in Vietnam, and least of all that I'd been a sniper in the Marine Corps. I mean, I was just a guy who had starting college late. I wouldn't, and then when I got in this business, same thing. For probably 20 years, nobody knew I'd been in the Marine Corps, or that I'd in Vietnam, because it wasn't a thing you could feel good about. We felt some shame about our participation in the war. We knew when we were there the war was wrong, that there was no basis for it, that it was a futile effort, that there were many things. The reason people won't talk about war, and I interviewed my sniper partner Jimmy Carter for the piece you spoke of. He said, "I don't talk about Vietnam. I won't talk about it now, and I don't want people to know what I did." No pride in that, like say World War II and these most recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was an immoral war. It was an illegal war. We shouldn't have been there. Those of us who went felt like we were patriots answering a call, but when we came back to the really negative response from folks, we just went underground, you know, plain and simple. And it wasn't until very recent years that I began to own up to it and to be proud of my service, because it didn't have anything to do. It had less to do with the war itself than with the fact that we were willing to serve, that we were willing to answer the call, because we can't cherry pick where we're going to serve, because then we don't have a system, you know. If and some people did in Vietnam, said, I'm not going to go to fight in that war, and they suffered the consequence of it. I can respect that. But if everybody does that, mm-hmm. well, first let me look at the war, and then I'll see if by that time we're overrun, you know, we lose. Wars are brought by policymakers. And then it's left to the citizenry to carry out the policy, the armed forces. And it has to be that way. So now I think we can take pride, those of us who fought there, in the fact that we did what we were asked to do, in spite of the fact that the war wasn't the most popular. It was not our finest moment. still, those who were there, we had individual stories. We formed a brotherhood that endures to this day. Many of, I've been very fortunate because I haven't suffered the consequences of that war as many of my brothers have, whom I pointed out in that story. I had four scout sniper partners, Jimmy Carter, Don Caberline, George Wilhite, and Leo Bettis. All but Jimmy are dead, suffered from things they suffered in Vietnam. Agent Orange, George Wilhite shot himself in 1973. Don Caberline died of lung cancer, never smoked. That war has took a terrible toll beyond the 58,000 who died there. Many, many more thousands died afterwards from things, either mental or physical, that afflicted them as a result of that war. I think I've been fortunate because while I didn't traipse through defoliated areas just as it happened, and also because I put it behind me. I'm very good at compartmentalizing. It never happened.
I was going to ask you that. Why do you think it didn't affect you from a mental health standpoint the way that it did so many others?
2 years of college in a liberal environment, not admitting where I'd been, and then getting into this business where we're essentially liberal, where we, because of the business we're in and how we conduct it, we don't... It helped me to become this instead of a steel worker. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Can you?
Yeah.
I mean, I was able to focus on this and compartmentalize that part of my life, put it over here, and was working with a number of like-minded people who didn't pry into my background. And if they had known, and as they began to understand it or become aware of it, were understanding and empathetic.
When did you feel safe enough to start to reveal your military history?
I think it was after the wall was erected in the 80s. I was sitting there watching it one Friday night. It was going to happen on that weekend, and I was sitting there watching it, and Bill Goodman, who was our news director, came up behind me, and he knew that I'd been in Vietnam, and he said, "Do you want to go?" I said, "Well, I would love to." He said, "Well, I'm going to send you, not to do a story, just to go." So I went. It was cathartic. For me and all of us who went. And I think it was then that I began to turn the corner on my role, you know. And then at some point, and right after that, the nation began to show an empathy. And slowly, we started to come out. And but it's been a process. It's been a long time. And then to be proud of it and to post about it and stuff like that, I would say the last 5 years.
Wow. I remember being on the desk with you on a few Veterans Days when you would start to say, you know, you would say Semper Fi and you would...
On Marine Corps birthday, yeah.
Yeah, on Marine Corps birthday. And then also on Veterans Day when you would acknowledge your service. And it was always a special moment. And I always felt proud to sit next to you.
Oh, thank you.
Especially on those days because, you know, it's people like you who are not afraid to answer the call, even if you don't agree with, like you say, this was the most unpopular war for so many reasons. And you could have not gone. You could have fled to Canada or whatever, like so many others did.
Oh, I would never have done that. I mean, I wanted to go. I wanted to serve. I mean, my dad had been a Marine in Korea, and it was always in my mind since I was a little boy that I was going to become a Marine. It just so happened that when I became a Marine, that's what was happening. Mm. The America has come to terms with how it treated, it couldn't separate the war from the warriors, and the mayor has come to terms with that and has felt badly about it and is trying to make up for it. And that's much appreciated by those of us who were there. And even proud of it, you know, war is war. You're shooting, they're shooting back. That's war. And at the time, all the politics of it is devoid of policy for the warriors. And so we weren't focused on that then, even though we knew how futile the whole thing was, you know. We didn't hold ground in that war. We didn't advance, hold the ground. We were fighting here, there, and everywhere over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So even a 19-year-old kid can say, well, this is kind of stupid. You know, what are we doing? The mission was search and destroy. Take as many casualties as we could. Inflict as many casualties, not take them, to inflict mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And the body count was everything in Vietnam. And we thought that somehow we could win a war if we killed them all. You know, that was the prevailing strategy of the war. Kill them all, let God sort them out. You can't win a war like that. And various people kept trying to tell Lyndon Johnson this, and later, and so, you know, he resigned. Kennedy really started, the build-up to the war, and then Johnson carried through. That was an entire enterprise. We occupied that country. We had so many assets there, buildings, people, personnel, millions of people, that it was just, people looked around and said, not only is this immoral and illegal, but we've got to get out of there somehow. And Nixon began the Paris peace talks, and eventually we left. And
have you ever been back?
No, and I'd love to go. For many years, I didn't want to, but now my son just got back from there.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Travis was there, and we had meant to go together. But maybe one day we will.
Had he always wanted to go to Vietnam?
I'd like to go back there because there's some things I need to close out. Accounts I need to clear. And I will. Maybe when I retire, because I'm going to spend a significant amount of time there. I have a lot of places to visit. It's going to be tough.
What was Travis's experience there?
He was only upcountry. He was in Hanoi, which is where, you know, the enemy was concentrated mostly, although it was also in the south in the form of the Viet Cong. But the North Vietnamese Army was headquartered in Hanoi. Their incursions all came from the north. To the extent we were there, it was only by air. You know, John McCain was shot down there, and we had many prisoners there. But so he was only in Hanoi, a place I'm not particularly anxious to go. I want to go to my battlegrounds. Mm. And, you know, I've looked at them on, you can go to Google Maps and take yourself right back there.
That must be very haunting
As you can see, it's still, you think, well, I'm over it.
Uh-huh.
52 years have passed since I came back, but, and this is the same for anybody who's ever been in war. Things happen. You never forget. People are lost. You will never forget. And you leave part of yourself there. And, you know, I was a sniper. And, you know, some snipers brag about the number of kills they've had. I don't. Particularly not in that situation. But what I do take solace in is that I save lives too by eliminating people who wanted to take those lives. And that's how I look at it. People say, how many people did you kill? I say, I know exactly how many people I killed, but I don't know how many people's lives I saved. And that's my focus. The people who came home because of our job, of our efforts. But, you know, I have some photographs of people whose lives I took because they were on the body with their wives and children. I like to take those back. One day, you know, and turn them back over.
You take the photographs back.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Having been through this war experience, and having gone through what it was like to come back and not feel welcome, but to feel ashamed of having been there because of the country's reaction. Mm-hmm. Having been through your career as a journalist, which is still going strong, and seeing all the changes and things that are happening, what would you want people to take away from your perspective in terms of how we might move forward and try to respect one another and our differences for the good of the country?
You know, what I want and what you want, I think, are noble and filled with altruism, and we can talk about it all we want, you know, and I think it's plain to people who are listening and watching what we want, and maybe they want it too, but we're you know, we've been in a process since the Civil War in this country. You know, you think about it; it wasn't that long ago.
I know.
I mean, it's amazing, and now we're in a cold Civil War, and we're in this process that may go until the end of the experiment we call democracy. In this experiment called America, in this very young country. And it may never be resolved. But, you know, isn't it amazing that in spite of all of that, you know, I'll leave here and I'll get in my car and I'll go home and wave people on the way and greet them in the grocery store. And we get along pretty darn well, even though we could do better. We've come a long way. And as I mentioned earlier, I think Houston has grown its tolerance and its acceptance because of the news media and our insistence on exposing one thing and another over time. You know, keep in mind, I'm not blaming the news media for what happened before I came here, because we weren't really formed then. Mm-hmm. When I came to Houston in 1973, news departments had only existed for about 5 or 6 years here, with sound cameras and full-fledged news departments. Before that, it was Bell and Hell silent film camera with the anchors voicing over. I mean, we didn't. And then we formed as departments and we began to cover the news and to give people voice in this community they never had before. And have been doing that, you know, since, say, the mid-60s. Before that, there wasn't any news here. So it's been a relatively short time, 55 years or so. And we got a long way to go. And I think we're doing a good job locally. I can't say that about national news. I think they're being extremely divisive, and they have there's an agenda, and it pays. You know, they may, when this president goes away, they may cease to exist. I don't know that there'll be five national news organizations presenting all the news that they do now. 4 hours in the morning, and you know all the stuff that they do. I just don't. I don't think that, you know, there won't be a story anymore.
Yeah, and the audience
and the credibility's gone. And the audiences are. That's the other great untold story. People have stopped watching television news. The network news has always been, say, you know, 5:30 in the evening. It's always been skewed to older people, 65 plus. As they go away, no one else is habituating themselves to watching network news. Our 10 o'clock news numbers right now across the board are the lowest they've ever been and declined. Our year over year was amazingly low in the May book. At 10 o'clock, people are watching Netflix or going to bed or doing other things. They're not making an appointment to sit there and watch the 10 o'clock news, which is what it is. If you wanted to watch 6 o'clock news 10 years ago, you said, well, it's 6 o'clock, turn the TV on. It was like an appointment television. People don't do that anymore. The people who, even the people who whose habit it is to do that are doing it less and less. And the people who are not habituated to it, the younger demographic, will never be. You know, because they've come up in the time of the telephone that's recording this interview, and it's all right there
at their fingertips.
Yes,
whenever they want it on demand.
They don't have to wait to find out what the score was or the weather's going to be or what's happened today. It's hitting them all day long.
Right.
You and I served in the best time that this business had.
Yeah.
And that time is not going to come back. It will go away. One day, instead of having 2, 11, and 13 providing all the news content there is, the economy won't sustain that. There'll probably be one television station providing English language news, several Spanish, because they do watch, and but they watch it in their language. Now, if you take a Planet Four or a Mattress Mac or, you know, the perennial sponsors of television news, they're having to spread their time between the cable news organizations, the internet, the radio, the Spanish language television, which predominates here. If you look at who's number one, it's not Channel 2, it's Telemundo or Univision.
Right.
We're number three in terms of homes using television at those hours.
Right.
So that's where the advertiser's money is going. Less and less and less of it comes to channels 2, 11, and 13. So eventually, when they can't, you know, you can't sustain a television news organization on the declining revenue, well, they'll go away, and there'll be one. And management understands that right now and is clawing as hard as they can to be the one that survives. You're nodding. You were aware of this?
Well, I'm not surprised.
I'm
not at all surprised because, I mean, just even the advent of you know podcasting. You know, this is a podcast, and you and I were talking about this before we went on the air before we started taping. So he's saying on the air. But you know, when I left the station, this kind of medium didn't really exist,
right.
And now it's just so interesting to see. I mean, the way that the technology has evolved, the double-edged sword is that anyone can do what we're doing, and anyone can do what we're doing.
If you
get what I'm saying,
you know
what I mean. So while I like to think that I have some pretty decent credentials as a journalist to be able to say, you know, this is kind of what I bring to the table, there are other people who don't have those credentials that, you know, are doing the same thing or something similar and disseminating information and you know, they may or not have the credentials, but they've got an audience. They've got an audience. And that's the democratization of news and information is what we're witnessing.
And when you're talking about news, to present real news, objective news that's well-researched and well-reported and well-presented by trained professionals, that costs money.
Right.
And so while anybody can go report and present, mm-hmm. they may be not be doing it in the way that that is accepted as factual. Mm-hmm. But they'll be doing it nonetheless.
Right.
And
right.
it's very inexpensive to do. You don't have to have sponsors to do that. All you need is a platform.
Right.
And they exist. And the platform that we're on now, there may be more platforms in 5 years we can't even foresee.
We can't even foresee or imagine what they might be.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Well, you know,
how much longer are you going to work before you decide to retire?
I was supposed to actually retire a year ago this past April. They haven't found my replacement yet. And so they asked me to extend 3 years until
excuse me.
June of 21.
Okay.
Which just coincidentally will be 50 years of broadcasting. I started in June of 71 and then June of 21 will be 50 years.
Wow.
Seems an awfully long time. I hear people say, well, you know, I worked in this business for 22 years when I retired, and it's a big deal, you know. But that's like...
You'll say, well, I worked in this business for 50 years before I retired.
Yeah, my perspective of what's a long time is skewed. But I've loved this. Mm-hmm. I've loved what I've been able to do in this business to be that mirror that turns, you know, on society, and here's what's going on. Here's how it's affecting us, and in small ways and large. And to travel around, you know, I mean, yeah. it's so addictive.
It is. It's, I love being in this business, and I know you do as well, and it's been such a pleasure and an honor to sit next to you all those years, but then
same
to actually
here.
Sit down, thank you, to sit down and talk to you, which I still can't believe, in your first extended on-camera interview, so... Thank
now you.
You
see why I've never done them before.
No, you were it was just beautiful to be able to talk to you. And thank you for being so open and so vulnerable and just, you know, sharing your heart and who you are.
Well, you know, this interview has uncovered things I didn't know about myself. I didn't know I still felt that I felt about things the way I do. And you've really made me see that. And... time will tell whether that was good or bad. Thank
Sounds
you.
Sounds like
that.
A follow-up to me.
I love you.
I love you, too. Thank you so much, Bill. You thank
bet.
You.
I've enjoyed it.
Good.
Thank you.
And thank you for giving our guest permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We'll see you next time.
I'm a firm believer that if we can find a way to better understand each other's experiences, we can find a way to respect and accept each other for who we are, even when we don't agree. That's the ultimate goal of this podcast. So with that in mind, what do you want the world to know about your story? How might your story, your truth, provide a different, important perspective and help bridge our divides? If you'd like to share your story with us and have a chance to be on the podcast, all you have to do is go to our website, ourvoicesmatterpodcast.com, and click on What's Your Story? We can't wait to hear from you because your voice matters.